My apologies, although I love French and read it a lot, I have no good chance to speak it often, so I'm ashamed to try to do it now. But thank you anyway for being patient, and thank you very much for this very kind introduction. I should say that this talk this afternoon is going to be illustrated. So if you get bored with what I'm saying, I hope you won't at least be bored with what I am going to show you on the screen, some of which I think is quite wonderful. Now, there's a very good recent book has just come out from a woman a sinologist, Rebecca Carr, who has brought together the information necessary to show something quite astonishing. And this is that although Chinese patriots in the 19th century gradually and painfully became accustomed to the idea that the Westerners were ahead of China, or rather that China was behind the West, and later they had the same painful experience vis-a-vis the Japanese after the Chinese defeat in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95, the really decisive thing for the Chinese intellectuals was what they discovered in the last 4 or 5 years of the 19th century. And what they discovered was that in the same week in which the treaty concluding the Sino-Japanese War was signed, the Treaty of Shimonoseki, which is April 1895. On the other side of the globe, Jose Marti in Cuba launched an invasion of colonial Cuba from what is today Florida and started the final great nationalist uprising there. And although he himself was rather quickly killed in battle, his generals were so successful that within a few months, the Spanish had to send the largest army ever sent up to that point across the Atlantic, over 200,000 troops. Following this, on the other side of the globe again, just about 12, 14 months later, Filipinos, also under Spanish colonial rule, seeing what was happening in Cuba, took advantage of the situation to launch their own insurrection, which was successful enough that the Spanish could not put it down. And eventually, in 1898, the First Republic of the Filipinos was proclaimed independence under President Aguinaldo. And although this was crushed by the Americans between 1900 and 1902, it was a very important moment. And lastly, in 1899, the Boers in South Africa started their heroic unequal struggle against the juggernaut of a savage Anglo-Saxon imperialism in South Africa. Now what Rebecca Carl shows is that if this triple three examples of small peoples in the Philippines, in South Africa, in Cuba, all at the same time, showing a courage, a determination, a radical discipline, which Imperial China itself had proved incapable. It was an astonishing moment when these Chinese intellectuals used to think about all these people as barbarians or unimportant or backward, suddenly recognized that they were ahead of China. And she says that it's from studying these revolutions that the Chinese intellectuals for the first time began to consider their struggle against the Manchu dynasty as an anti-colonial struggle. And it was the first time also that they came to have some kind of conception of what it might be, what the meaning in concrete terms might be of revolution. So this is the interesting thing, this coordination between Cuba, South Africa, Philippines, and China, or at least the kind of intellectual coordination. Now the question is, what made it possible? How did this actually come to the Chinese? And here I think that the most important thing to bear in mind, and this is why I think that the last quarter of the 19th century really is the beginning of serious globalization. The thing that marked off the end of the 19th century, above all, was the invention for the first time and its practical utilization of a means of communication which traveled infinitely faster than human beings themselves could do. And this, of course, was the commercial telegraph. And that's why even today many newspapers in various countries, the worst of them probably is in London, the Daily Telegraph, but there are others like this, record this moment when it became possible through the use of submarine cables under the major oceans to send messages in an extraordinarily rapid period of time. And first it's messages, it can be coded messages or real messages, and later, of course, it became possible around 1908 or 9 even to send photographs through this method. Now, just how fast were telegrams? Well, we have a wonderful example from 1903 when President Theodore Roosevelt, who was a very vain man, decided to send himself a telegram around the world. So he addressed a telegram to the great President Theodore Roosevelt, sent it off through the network around the world. And anybody can guess how quickly it came back to him? Anybody want to try? Faster than early internet, I promise you. 9 minutes. It was very fast. And it increasingly was used not just by governments and agencies, but also by individuals. It was expensive, but it was rapid and was not easy to monitor. But the importance of the telegram, or the telegraph in this context, is that it linked up with something else, which was the General Postal Union of 1876, where all the major countries in the world, including their colonies, agreed on the need to facilitate and make as efficient as possible the movement of postal services, books, magazines, newspapers, letters, all kinds of things. And it was worked very well and very efficiently. And this created the possibility for massive communication networks around the world which are carried partly by railways, partly by steamships, which were all the year round, steady, regular schedules and so forth. So the point is that by the end of the 19th century it was possible for young Chinese reading vernacular newspapers in the coastal ports of China to see on the same page of the newspaper the latest by telegram of what was happening in Cuba, in the Philippines, and in South Africa on the same page. And not much later was possible to get even pictures of what was going on in these places. And what this basically meant, it became possible to imagine a kind of coordinated political action. Not something that was sort of, well, I know what they're doing and we'll do our own thing, but something that was much more interactive, much more fed from one side of the world to the other. Now, it should also be said that the speed up of communications was important not only for commodities but for human beings. And as you all know, the 19th century, late 19th century especially, was a time of massive immigrations from Europe to the Americas, to North America, to South America, to Australia, and so forth. And these are people from all different parts of Europe, but not only Christian Europe, also from Muslim Europe. You find all over South America, for example, people who are now referred to as Turcos or Turks, but actually they're not Turks. They are Lebanese, they're Syrians, and so forth. But they came when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, was still in existence. And that's part of the migration. It's also true that these migrants brought with them many of the political constellations, the political ideas, the political ambitions that they had been schooled in Europe. And that's why we find a huge spread, for example, of anarchist newspapers, magazines, meeting houses, all the way up from Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Havana, Florida, New Jersey, New York, and so forth, and so up to Canada. But there were also people taking advantage of the new means of communication to go not away from Europe, but into it. And some of the most striking early examples are third world people going to study in the imperial centers. And we can find this actually already in the 1860s and 1870s. From the Caribbean, some beginning from British India. But the ones that really interest me in this particular context are the people who started to come really from enormously far away, from the Philippines in the 1870s, and especially in the early 1880s. And these people, like the, can I have the first one? The man who is today regarded as the father of the Philippine nation, Jose Rizal, who was born in 1861 and went to Europe on a Dutch liner, which took him past the Chateau d'If to Marseille and on to study in Spain. He didn't think it was in the least peculiar that he could get a luxury Dutch liner to take him from Singapore to Spain to study. And he wasn't the only one. Many people were making this pilgrimage, if you like, not out of Europe, but into Europe, from the Americas, from South Asia, from East Asia, and so forth. And he was part of this movement. Now, the And the same man, eventually, on another trip, went from his home country to Japan, where he stayed 2 or 3 months, then went on to San Francisco, took a 7-day railway trip across the United States to Manhattan, rushed on across the Atlantic Ocean to Liverpool and so forth. I mean, what is really striking about this period is the way in which third world patriots completely adapted themselves to the new with systems of communication, sending telegrams to each other, to meet each other, to send each other money and so forth, as they were making their way around the world. And this kind of sense of mobility, of transcontinental travel, of transcontinental community, comes out very strikingly in the actions of the revolutionary government of General Aguinaldo, proclaimed in 1898. It was one of the first things he did was to send emissaries to places like colonial Java, to Shanghai, to Hong Kong, to Japan, to create favorable contacts, to see if he could get weapons, get political support, create public sympathy for the Republic. And one of the most interesting things that one could discover from the correspondence of his main agent outside the Philippines, a man called Mariano Ponce.
And you, the second one?
These are three of the heroes of the Philippine independence movement. Rizal is on the left. Man who's sitting on the right is Ponce, who was this external agent based in Hong Kong and in Yokohama. And what's interesting is when he writes to his great friend, and his great friend happens to be an Austrian living somewhere not too far away from Munich, he writes to him and says that the Japanese are extremely weird people, extremely exotic to me. I have no idea how their system works. and I have to speak to them in English. He's writing to this Austrian friend in Spanish. But he proceeds very efficiently and effectively with this English, and some very remarkable things happened while he's there. First of all, he managed to get a lot of young Japanese excited about the Philippine Revolution, even if some of them had rather sinister motives as well. He manages to get a meeting with none other than Sun Yat-sen. Here is Sun Yat-sen in Ponce's home in Yokohama. Here is Ponce looking very European. They both have great mustaches. And it's really amazing the coordination that becomes possible, because a huge shipment of arms is actually made available to the Filipinos thanks to a rich friend, Chinese friend of Sun Yat-sen, and also behind the scenes to some support from the Japanese Army's chief of staff. Unfortunately, this big ship full of weapons and so forth, is wrecked in a storm, so it never actually got to the Philippines. So there's one kind of, or another part of this network was that Ponce discovered a Japanese who could actually read and translate Spanish. And so he quickly wrote a book about the problems of the Philippine Revolution, which was immediately translated into Japanese and also almost immediately into Chinese. And so there were hundreds and thousands of Chinese students and Korean students in Japan at that time. And so, as it were, the lessons of what the Filipino Revolution could provide quickly entered the discourse of radical young Japanese, Koreans, and Chinese. So that was one important network for anti-colonial, as it were, propaganda and trying to get help. But the other one is no less important, and this is the one with the... I should say another thing, so I made a mistake. One very striking indication of the attractive power of this transnational nationalist appeal was a fascinating story of a young Chinese who emigrated from Southeast China to the Philippines, Manila, at the age of 18 with his uncle. He was illiterate at that time and started up as an apprentice blacksmith. But when the revolution broke out, he immediately joined it, and under the very un-Chinese name of Ignatius Power, he became one of the most loved battle commanders, a major arms manufacturer from his days as an ironsmith, and in fact also an interpreter. And there's some wonderful descriptions of him dressed up in a regular military uniform, but with his pigtail still on, and with the native, as it were, Filipino troops surrounding him with great admiration and affection. I just thought you'd have a nice have a look of a young Chinese who joined and helped lead the Filipino Revolution. He looks very young, and he was, I think, 24 at the time, but was already a brigadier general. Now, let me move to the other side of the world, which is the connections to Cuba. Because when the Filipinos started to go to Spain to get their education in the 1880s, the Cubans and the Puerto Ricans had been there quite a long time before. And they used to go to the same kind of bars, they used to go to the same, as it were, discotheques. They weren't discotheques in those days, but that kind of thing. I'm sure they went to the same brothels. They went to join the same Masonic clubs because they were fellow colonials. But the Filipinos were very aware that they were less advanced. The status of their country was lower down than Cuba's or Puerto Rico's were. But they were important personal links created in Spain during those days when nothing much was going on. The interesting thing is that the minute that the two revolutions broke out, the Filipinos started, we had a lot of the correspondents writing, cabling to the Filipinos the Cubans, not in Havana itself, which was under control of Spain, as the revolutionaries were in the countryside, but to Cuban representatives in New York, and especially in Paris. Paris was an absolutely key place where Cubans wanted to stay out of control of the Spanish, but close enough to Spain to keep an eye on what was going on there. And these letters and these cables are fascinating because what they do is to address the Cubans as our elder brothers. You have so much more experience in doing revolution. You know how to run guerrilla wars. We don't know how to do it yet. Can you send us all your manuals on how to make guns? Do you have any guns that you would sell us and help us? What kind of constitution do you have? We need more guidance about this. It's really quite fascinating. And the Cubans do their best. They, in fact, do send them a copy of the revolutionary constitution, which the Filipinos look at and say, well, that's fine, that's what we do for us too. It's exactly the same constitution, except for one sentence that says the national language will be Tagalog. The Cubans from New York send them a long list of bombs and mortars and grenades. You get a discount for these two. Let us know how much you want and how you want to be paid. And it's quite clear that the Cubans also think it's useful to have the Filipinos making trouble for the Spanish while they are actually bearing the brunt of the anti-colonial effort. So there is this coordination which goes on through the great general postal union, also goes on through telegrams, and also a great deal of travel was involved as well. Now, what I want to do is to mention to you one fascinating aspect of the Third World encounter with Europe, which is not much up till now been noticed. And that is, what did the these Filipinos, when they came to Europe, think about what they experienced there? And a very striking example, which will lead to the last part of what I have to say today, which is about the links with anarchism, is this interesting case of Filipinos' most famous painter of the 19th century.
Next picture.
This is Juan Luna painting himself to look, I think, a bit better looking than he actually was. But it has a nice sort of Byronic look to it. And he basically tried to make a living doing portraits of, you know, good-looking women and so forth. But he did go to one of the worst industrial factories in Paris, an iron metalworking factory, and wrote an extraordinary letter describing how grim it was. He said, "I was only in there for 2 minutes, and already I could feel as if the whole of my body was nothing but iron filings, dust, poisons of various kinds." And he said, "You know, the poor wretches who live here will suddenly die within 2 or 3 years of lead poisoning, chemical poisoning, and so forth." I mean, he gives a horrendous description of what it's like. And then he says, because it's a letter to Rizal, this hero, he said, "You really ought to go and see this, because if you do, you will realize that however miserable our fellow countrymen are under colonialism, they are fortunate by comparison with these wretched French workers." It's really an extraordinary moment when all the expectations of colonialism, which is we are the most miserable people in the world, are quite honestly confronted. He said, "No, there's nobody in the Philippines who lives in this industrial horror that of the time." And it's this kind of sense that there were problems in Europe also which had relevance for anti-colonial nationalists, the first generation, which is one of the things that brings them into contact with anarchism in very interesting ways. So I will now switch over to anarchism, and we'll get a lot of pictures now. First of all, the anarchist network was a, it's important to remember it today, after the death of Marx in 1883, Engels sort of struggled on, not terribly successfully, and actually, sort of strictly speaking, Marxism was largely confined to Protestant Northern Europe and was not hugely successful anywhere else. The dominant stream in leftist thinking in the last quarter of the 19th century was undoubtedly anarchism. And in figures such as, this is, by the way, this is one of Luna's, sorry, I forgot to mention this, this is one of his drawings of these workers. It's called, let's see, Un Moi Malheureux. One of his pictures of unemployed or miserable French workers.
Okay.
Okay, you all recognize this splendid figure, Russian prince, who became, as it were, Bakunin's successor in the anarchist movement, major theoretician of anarchism, and the other great charismatic figure of the time. The next one. This is Errico Malatesta, the famous Italian anarchist, also an important writer, and the man who in Paris was called Le Pape, the Pope of anarchism, which was Jean Graff, who was the editor of the most important intellectual journal of anarchism, which was La Révolte.
Now,
the crucial thing about this anarchism and its connection to anti-colonialism is that anarchism had its sort of population centers, as it were, basically in Romance Europe. The countries that where anarchism was really important was, of course, Spain above all, Italy, France, Portugal, and the places like Spanish-speaking Florida, Spanish-speaking South America, Portuguese-speaking South America, and so forth. It has its intellectual capital in Paris, but its mass base in early industrial and hacienda-ridden Italy, Spain, and so forth. Now, to understand the curious linkage between anti-colonial nationalism and this internationalist movement, there are two things one has to bear in mind. The first thing is that, obviously, pure nationalism is virtually impossible, because nationalism can't explain anything beyond the nation itself, and it has no way to talk about anything international or comparative. And it needs a supplement, and these supplements are provided by various forms of universalist or quasi-universalist philosophies. This could be liberalism, they can be conservatism, they can be fascism, they can be communism, and so forth. Now, the interesting thing in this period that I'm thinking about, early anti-globalization movements, or you would say in some way they were globalization movements, is the way in which these two things got together. If you look, for example, at José Martí's writings, which are about anarchism, he's very against anarchism in many ways. He said anarchists don't understand the importance of the state. They're irresponsible, they run around and can't get organized about anything, and they're not disciplined, and their morals are sometimes not altogether desirable. At the same time, anarchists also said, well, we're not sure about whether these anti-colonial nationalists are not really just wanting to sit in the places where the white colonials have been up till now, simply to take their place and go on repressing their fellow countrymen, just getting rid of the foreign overlords. But even if that was the case, even if there were suspicions and so forth, nonetheless, they had the enemy in common. They were all against the empires, they were all against imperialists, and at one point, they were all against capitalism, or at least foreign capitalism. So the alliance was quite real, even though that doesn't mean that there was any sort of deep consensus between the two. Now, the anarchism was attractive, and it is important to understand why anarchism, as it were, was dominant in many ways over Marxism after Marx's death. And I think that the things that are important to bear in mind is that the anarchists were much less hostile to what Marx called rural idiocy. They were much more open to organizing among rural laborers, small farmers, and so forth. They were perfectly willing to be much more violent than Marx was, at least for the time being, prepared to be. They had great respect for individuals, and therefore were very attractive to petty bourgeois or bourgeois intellectuals, many of whom in the late 19th century were strongly sympathetic to anarchism, which seemed to give them a kind of room which the Marxist tradition did not, at least not after Marx's death. There are all these reasons why anarchism was actually quite attractive, not just to third world people, but also to metropolitan avant-garde people, as we'll see in a minute. And they were also, in a sense, much more media savvy. And you can get this very clearly from the following picture, which is an anti-anarchist cartoon from the late 19th century. And you can see here, anarchism is here, and trying to blow up law, religion, and property. This isn't communists doing this, this is anarchists, and this is the specter that is haunting Europe, actually, in the late 19th century. It's not, in fact, communism. What is haunting Europe is anarchism. Now, the intellectual headquarters, as I mentioned, for anarchism was Paris, and the World Journal was Jean Grave's La Revolte. And I want to show you just two pictures of the editorial board and of the place where the journal was published in Montmartre. Here are the people, as it were, with the keyboard and the internet in front of them, preparing the next issues. And here, the next picture, is the house. Upstairs was where the editorial offices of La Revolte was located. Now, the interesting thing is this, that when the police finally got around to raiding this journal in the mid-1890s, they were astonished by two things. First of all, where this journal found its subscribers. It had about 7,000 subscribers at that point. These lived not only in France and French Algeria, but also in the US, Chile, Belgium, Romania, Brazil, India, Spain, Holland, Guatemala, Egypt, Argentina, Switzerland, and the United States. That's absolutely astounding distribution, doubtless made possible by the General Postal Union. But furthermore, they discovered that the Paris subscribers included a huge majority of the city's most famous writers and artists. People like Mallarmé, people like Charles Calvismas, Anatole France, Camille Pissarro, Georges Seurat, Paul Signac, and others. Anarchists were also tireless and open-minded translators. When Rizal's famous first anti-colonial novel was finally translated into a foreign language 3 years after his execution, it was done in Paris by a team of one Catalan anarchist and one French anarchist. And it was published in a series of anarchist classics, sandwiched, as it were, between Bakunin, Malatesta, and Charles Herbert's path-breaking book on L'amour libre. Why should it have been so? Well, here again, one has to remember that that generation of avant-garde intellectuals and painters had all gone through the experience of the Paris Commune and the horrors that had been inflicted on the city by the government of Thiers. And you remember that in 2 weeks of May 1871, more people were executed savagely executed by the returning government than had been killed in all the period of Robespierre's terror. It was far more systematic, far more faster, and far more bloody. And this had remained with the French intellectuals, many of whom had been sympathetic to the, or even participated in the Paris Commune. So this was an intellectual class very alienated from the existing bourgeois order. And Léon Blum was later to say, the man who became Prime Minister of France in 1910, to say all the intellectuals of my generation are profoundly imbued with the anarchist spirit and anarchist writing. Now, the next thing, and this is where we get to some more complicated things, is that the anarchists learned a lot from the activities of the Nihilists and Narodniks in Russia in the 1860s and 1870s. And we can see the thing that had the major impact on them in the following picture. This is the assassination of Tsar Alexander II on March 1st, 1881 by a bomb. In fact, it's an interesting case because the bomb also contained a dynamite which had only recently been patented by Nobel. And you can think about Nobel's invention as the first weapons of mass destruction available to the poor and the downtrodden. The man who threw the bomb discovered that the first bomb hadn't actually killed the Tsar, so he picked up the second bomb and ran with it on his chest and exploded it when he got close to the Tsar, as it were, knowing that he would be killed in the same explosion. So we even have, as it were, an early suicide bomber. Not in the Muslim East, but in the anarchist West. Now, following from this, and it's a really very striking, and we're just going to show you some pictures of this, anarchists decided on something which they called the tactic of propaganda by the deed. And it's very important to understand the two sides of that. The deed was assassination of major political villains. But the point was to kill in such a way that the killing itself could be effective anarchist propaganda. Now, the success rate was really quite astonishingly high. In the 7 years between 1894 to 1901, anarchists assassinated by various means the President of France, Prime Minister of Spain, the King of Italy, Empress of Austria-Hungary, and the President of the United States. And while most of the assassins were young Italians, who had a long and honorable history of tyrannicide behind them, they were followed quickly by nationalists. And the most celebrated one, of course, is the Serbian nationalist who killed Franz Ferdinand and precipitated the onset of World War I. But it's striking that this pattern of nationalist assassinations copying what the anarchists had started had already reached Korea by before 1910, when the famous Japanese oligarch, Prince Ito, was assassinated by a young Korean nationalist. Not in Korea, but in Manchuria. Let me show you some pictures from of these events. Here is the young Italian, very young, his name was Sante Geronimo Caserio, stabbing to death stabbing to death the president, French president C.D. Carnot, who had just refused to halt the execution of the man who had in fact not even killed anybody. Here is Santi Viseri himself, looking very much like, in my view, a sort of young K-Fire movie star. My fantasy. And this is what happened to him next. He was, of course, immediately in the pilot run away. He was very proud of what he'd done. He was a guillotine, and this is his head. Next one. This is the Spanish Prime Minister Canovas, who was responsible for the repressions in Cuba, and as you shall see, heavy repressions of anarchists in Catalonia and also in the Philippines. Next one. This is the assassination of the Empress of Austria. She actually hadn't done anything terribly bad, but she was one of the few of these people who was killed who was not a major villain. The next one. Here is the assassination of President McKinley in Buffalo, not very far away from us, by the Polish immigrant anarchist Leon Trogowski. So there you get a sort of picture of these various groups. Now, what's striking about these assassinations? Oh, I think there's one more, sorry. This is Chagos, and one more picture. This is the assassination of the Archduke by the Serbian nationalist. I always like his hat. That one has to go and, you know, do a murder, but one has to have a hat on when one does it. Okay, maybe we could have the next one. The important thing about this is the anarchist assassins typically didn't try to escape. They knew they were going to be executed, and it was precisely their execution which was part of the propaganda on which they were thinking. They typically went to their deaths with great courage, shouting, as it were, Viva l'Anarchia, of Vive l'Anarchie, up to the last. And this is an execution, a French execution, of a man who tried to throw a bomb into the French Parliament, which certainly deserved it. But he didn't actually kill anybody. But this is how the executions were done in those days. And the repression from the state, of course, was often very ferocious. Here's what happened in Barcelona. Next one. These are killings of these sort of KKK-looking like people. Actually, are actually priests who were very upset about anarchist attacks on religion and so forth. Now, the point about the going to your death in an admirable way was that these killings were designed to be picked up by the telegram. That is, these killings were done with an eye to spectacularity, with the idea that, as it happened with the killing of Alexander II by the Nihilists or the Maronidi, that within minutes, all around the world, people knew about this. It was important, therefore, to have, as it were, put your signature on these killings. You would know why you had done these killings. And what would do that for you was the telegram and the newspaper, the new popular newspapers, which were spreading everywhere. So these people became, you know, international figures with extraordinary speed. And that was the reason why they called it propaganda by the deed. That it was designed, as it was thought, to terrify the villains in power, and at the same time it was designed to give moral example, political teaching to the oppressed, and so forth. Now, what's curious about this, and I'm getting to the end, is how this spins back onto the anti-colonial circuit. And let me show you an example, of astonishing example, of how this actually was possible. In 1891, that is before all these assassinations started, that's the interesting thing, Rizal wrote an extraordinary second anti-colonial novel, which was called El Filibusterismo, which means the subversive. And the plot of the story, or one of the main plots, is a plan by a mysterious figure who we learn later on is actually somebody in the first novel who was thought was dead, which is to present, to go to a wedding party among the top colonial elite and offer a very luxurious present in the form of a lamp made to look like by jewels, gold, etc., to make to look like a kind of extraordinary Fabergé pomegranate. But inside the pomegranate, there would be explosives. And at a certain point, when the wick and the lamp went down, the bomb would go off, and the entire colonial elite would be obliterated. It's actually an astonishing idea, and it almost comes off just by an accident that this actually doesn't blow up everybody in the end. But to think about why somebody is writing an anti-colonial novel in 1881 with this kind of fantasy, this kind of look to the future, where does it come from? Because nobody had even dreamed of anything like this in the colony itself. And assassinations like this, of course, never happened. And what we can see is that what Rizal has got in some ways, been reading the tabloids, he also has some idea of the what I call the language of social fury in Europe, the language of the anarchists in Andalusia, the anger of the industrial workers and so forth, really from the time of the French Revolution. But what he's done is to marry it to something else. And it's that something else which is really quite fascinating. That is, where does the pomegranate-shaped bomb made out of gold and silver and jewels and so forth? This doesn't come from real life, it comes from novels. And those of you who know your French literature will recognize quickly that it comes from Joris Karl Huysmans' famous novel, Arbour, and also from novels like Eugène Sue's, Les Mystères de Paris, and so forth. So an extraordinary, as it were, crossover has taken place between the productions of the avant-garde, because Joris Karl Huysmans was definitely a major avant-garde figure in that period, with the popular writing in Paris and probably in Spain as well. And it somehow crosses with real life anarchism and real life Narodnik violence in Russia to produce this extraordinary text. Okay, I'm going to
conclude with just one quick thing. It's simply to say that
I want to just show you one picture, which is the picture of this man. This man was a young Italian called Michele Angiolillo, born near Naples. He was an anarchist from very early on, and was chased by the Italian state, fled to Spain, after that was arrested by the police, went to Marseille, was expelled to Brussels, and so forth and so forth. The crucial thing about this young man was that he was in Spain at the time when the Spanish state was arresting and torturing large numbers of anarchists as well as anti-colonial revolutionaries. So there were Filipinos imprisoned in the jail in Barcelona, this torture jail. There were Cubans, there were Puerto Ricans, and there were Catalans and so forth. And he was perfectly aware of that because he was trying to find a job in Barcelona at the time and was protected by young Italian immigrants into the city. And later, he found his way to England. And while he was there, he bought himself a revolver. He attended a major rally in Trafalgar Square where victims of the tortures in the prison of Barcelona showed their bodies to the public. He heard lectures by leading intellectuals and anarchist theoreticians, which in his mind linked Cuba, torture in Barcelona, and the executions and repressions in the Philippines. He made his way to Paris, talked to some important Cuban, Puerto Rican revolutionaries, made his way down to Spain, followed the Spanish Prime Minister to his vacation spot in the Basque Country, checked in at the same hotel, and after watching him for a couple of days, found him reading a newspaper in the lobby and shot him to death. And the first who did this, this is Angiolillo himself. He again didn't try to escape, and he was executed 2 weeks later. But he did say that he had done this because Cánovas was a villain who had responsible for murders, executions, tortures, and horrors on 3 continents. And the world had to be rid of him. Now, the importance of Angiolillo compared to the others is this, that it was because the powerful figure of Cánovas was really responsible for the maintaining of the empire by the, whatever means. It was essentially the fall or the death of Cánovas that the whole Spanish imperial regime started to crumble, making it way possible for the Americans to move in Cuba and eventually in the Philippines. So that it can be said that in this particular case, the anarchists, young man really made possible, enormously facilitated, the possibility of the early moments of Philippine independence in 1898-99. The sad thing, of course, is that in the Philippines today, nobody's ever heard of him. Thank you.